See now, the Lord Almighty, is about to take from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support, all supplies of food and all supplies of water. The hero and the warrior, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the man of rank, the counselor, skilled craftsman, and clever enchanter. I will make mere youths their officials. Children will rule over them. People will oppress each other, man against man, neighbor against neighbor. The young will rise up against the old, the nobody against the honored. A man will seize one of his brothers in his father's house and say, "You have a cloak, you be our leader. Take charge of this heap of ruins." But in that day he will cry out, "I have no remedy. I have no food or clothing in my house. Do not make me the leader of the people." Jerusalem staggers. Judah is falling. Their words and deeds are against the Lord, defying his glorious presence. The look on their faces testifies against them. They parade their sin like Sodom. They do not hide it. Woe to them. They have brought disaster upon themselves. Tell the righteous it will be well with them, for they will enjoy the fruit of their deeds. Woe to the wicked. Disaster is upon them. They will be paid back for what their hands have done. Youths oppress my people. Women rule over them. My people, your guides lead you astray. They turn you from the path. The Lord takes his place in court. He rises to judge the people. The Lord enters into judgment against the elders and leaders of his people. It is you who have ruined my vineyard. The plunder from the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor? Declares the Lord Almighty. The Lord says, the women of Zion are haughty, walking along with outstretched necks, flirting with their eyes, strutting along with swaying hips, with ornaments jingling on their ankles. Therefore, the Lord will bring sores on the heads of the women of Zion. The Lord will make their scalps bald. In that day, the Lord will snatch away their finery, the bangles and headbands and crescent necklaces, the earrings and bracelets and veils, the headdresses and anklets and sashes, the perfume bottles and charms, the signet rings and nose rings, the fine robes and the capes and the cloaks, the purses and mirrors, and the linen garments and tiaras and shawls. Instead of fragrance, there will be a stench. Instead of a sash, a robe. Instead of well-dressed hair, baldness. Instead of fine clothing, sackcloth. Instead of beauty, branding. Your men will fall by the sword, your warriors in battle. The gates of Zion will lament and mourn. Destitute, she will sit on the ground. In that day, seven women will take hold of one man and say, "We will eat our own food and provide our own clothes. Only let us be called by your name. Take away our disgrace." In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious. And the fruit of the land will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel.
Marco, thank you very much. It'd be great if you could keep your Bible open at those two pages that we've had read to us this morning, Isaiah chapter 2, verse 6, up to chapters 4, verse 6 on page 688. And I've given it the title, Finding Self-Esteem and Confidence, something that we very much feel we need in our lives and in our society, self-esteem and confidence. This is Andrew Sims. He's a past president of the Royal College of Psychiatry and has worked as a psychiatrist at St. James's Hospital in Leeds and teaching now in Leeds University. And he's also a Christian. And he wrote this. He wrote, "The dilemma of self-esteem has troubled me for more than 40 years. I know from my everyday practice that people are crippled by low self-esteem. But what I've learned as a Christian directs me to deny myself and put others first. How does one reconcile these apparently conflicting ideas. Do you see the problem? We're very aware in our culture, as we're raising our children, as we're living our own lives, that one of our biggest issues is the struggle to find self-esteem. And there's a lot of focus on that. There's a lot of focus on that as the problem and ways to solve that problem, whether you're watching a Disney movie or in a school assembly or reading a book on therapy. There's a lot of focus on how to improve that self-esteem. But Andrew Sims goes on to talk about how the Christian faith offers something radically different, which at first sight might seem like a bad idea. Might seem to talk of humility and to talk of serving others and loving others, to talk of crucified with Christ, all of those, denying self, all of those things might sound like a really bad idea in this culture of self-esteem. But he goes on to say, actually, this is a much better solution. He talks about the very positive remedy of amazing grace. To stop judging ourselves, to be compassionate to ourselves, yes, but to really take the focus off ourselves. Instead of trying to look at our low self-esteem and tell ourselves we're amazing and try and lift ourselves into what he describes as kind of the dangers of narcissism and self-obsession and self-absorption, he says, well, that actually doesn't really make things better. He writes this in an introduction to a book by Glyn Harrison called The Big Ego Trip, which argues that this is what often we try to do. We see the low self-esteem and we try to replace it with something that is sort of boosterism, self-worth, self-value, that in the end doesn't really ring true and doesn't really win over people, and doesn't help as many people as we think it should help. C.S. Lewis spoke about humility. You probably know the author, C.S. Lewis, wrote the Narnia stories as well. And he said that Christian humility is often misunderstood. It's not thinking less of ourselves, but thinking of ourselves less. It's not thinking less of ourselves, but thinking of ourselves less. And I think that this is where Isaiah is going in what he says in the two chapters that we had read to us. And especially really summed up in chapter 2, verse 22, which is at the end of chapter 2, halfway through the reading. Chapter 2, verse 22, is really saying this: stop trusting mere people. It's worth just focusing on that verse. Get our heads around that, and then the rest of it, I think, will make more sense. Stop trusting in mere humans who have but a breath in their nostrils. Why hold them in esteem? It is very hard to put your confidence, to trust in, to depend on, to put your faith and rely on and count on. It's very hard to do that when you're just talking about people. Because what are people, he says here? They have but a breath in their nostrils. In other words, we take a breath, and then if we're not able to take our next breath, then that's the end of us. We're that fragile. We're that weak. We're not really dependable at all. We're just human. We're mere humans, but a breath in our nostrils. Why hold them in esteem? What do you see in your own humanity or in the other people that you rely on? What do you see in them that makes you think that you should be holding them in esteem? Isaiah says there's really not enough there to justify that confidence. Stop trusting in mere humans who have but a breath in their nostrils. Why hold them in esteem? Of course, the Bible passage is going to go on and compare that to trusting in God. Trusting in the Creator who sustains us. Trusting in Jesus who showed his love and died for us and conquered death through the resurrection and his presence in our lives. A much better place to put our confidence. Stop trusting mere people. Well, let's look at how Isaiah unpacks that. He starts by focusing on their pride. That really is the big issue and the big problem that they had at the time and that we perhaps still have now. Stop trusting mere people. Stop trusting in their pride. That's the rest of chapter 2. Chapter 2, verses 6 to 21 is about that. In other words, Isaiah is saying, don't be impressed by the arrogant, by the boastful, by the impressive human beings around you. Don't always compare yourself to them and think you should be as good as them or convince yourself you're better than them. That pride, that arrogance, that boastfulness, it, It didn't really amount to anything because it is all going to evaporate and disappear. It's all going to be gone. And in Isaiah's time, it was going to be gone quite soon. And Isaiah was telling them what was going to happen. So chapter 2, verse 6. You, Lord, have abandoned your people, the descendants of Jacob. So God, Isaiah here, he's talking about what God is doing that with his city in his lifetime, the city of Jerusalem, the descendants of Jacob, the Jewish people. In Isaiah's time, they've been abandoned. In other words, the enemy, the neighboring countries, they're attacking, they're invading. And God is not saying, I'm going to protect you. I'm not going to protect you anymore. I'm going to leave you to it. I'm going to let them defeat you. You're going to be abandoned to them. And the reason for that is because they're so much full of self-confidence and pride that they're not really interested in God anymore. And they're not relying on him. And their pride and their arrogance is leading them to do all kinds of terrible things, particularly to oppress the poor. So once the city was full of justice, that's what Isaiah said in an earlier chapter, the city was full of justice. What is it full of now? Chapter 2, verse 6, you, Lord, have abandoned your people, the descendants of Jacob. They're full of superstitions from the east. They practice divination like the Philistines and embrace pagan customs. Verse 7, their land is full of silver and gold. There is no end to their treasures. Their land is full of horses. There is no end to the chariots. Their land is full of idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their fingers have made. They're full of all these other things. They're full of superstition. Any kind of wacky, crazy idea they can find, whether it's in the east or the Philistines in the west, they'll grab it and they'll adopt it. They're full of superstition, full of silver and gold. They've got plenty of money, doing very well for themselves. They're wealthy. There's no end to their treasures. They never feel they're going to run out. They're full of horses and no end to their chariots. They feel strong. They feel we've got a lot of military power. You know, horses and chariots don't sound impressive to us, but, you know, they've got the best tanks. They've got the best warplanes. They've got the chemical weapons, the nuclear weapons. They don't feel they're in any danger from others. And worst of all, they're full of idols. Instead of bowing down to the real God who made them and who's really in control, they're so focused on themselves, they would rather make something themselves and bow down to that. I made this. Look at this. This is mine. It's a work of my hands. They're full of idols. And when you have a lot, when your life is really full and you have plenty, isn't there the danger that you'll just feel very confident, overconfident, proud, arrogant, boastful, self-reliant. And that is the trap that they've fallen into. And Isaiah is saying that can only last so long. Because there is a real God of the universe, and he doesn't put up with any rival. And he'll allow us, very tiny people, to walk around for a while pretending that we're God of the universe. But he won't allow that forever. Sooner or later, he's going to put an end to that, and that's what he was going to do for Jerusalem in Isaiah's time. Human pride was coming face to face with God. So chapter 2, verse 11, the eyes of the arrogant will be humbled and human pride brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. The Lord Almighty has a day in store for all the proud and lofty, for all that is exalted. And they will be humbled. So for Jerusalem, in about 700 and something BC, Isaiah is saying, God has put a date in his diary. There's the day of the Lord is coming, and he's going to humble this city. He's going to bring down their pride and their arrogance. Anything and anyone that is overconfident and boastful and self-important will lose out. He talks about it as the day of the Lord. And Isaiah goes on to say, it doesn't matter how tall and great they think they are. Verses 13 to 16, they think they're like the tallest trees and mountains or the highest towers and ships. However great they imagine themselves to be, God will bring them down in the end. Verse 17. Verse 17. The arrogance of man, the arrogance of humanity, in other words, will be brought low and human pride humbled. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. Now that is worth remembering, isn't it? When we see pride in our own hearts, when we look at proud and powerful people around it. It is worth remembering that just as that came to an end in Isaiah's time, just as God wouldn't tolerate it forever, so Jesus has said it's going to come to an end for the whole of human history. There will be a time when God won't allow us to think of ourselves as more important than him. In some ways, that's reassuring. We might think of the pride of the president of Russia, thinking that he can do what he likes and that he's powerful enough, that he doesn't really have to answer to international law. He's got his tanks and his weapons and he can conquer countries. But his reign will come to an end and his life will come to an end, like so many other dictators and regimes have in the past. Or we might think on a much smaller scale of party politics in our own country. We've had local elections this week. I don't know if you spotted that and voted or if it passed you by, but we did. A lot of talk about Partygate. I don't know what you think of that, whether you believe the Prime Minister's apology and feel that he's genuinely humbled. He didn't seem very humble to start with. I'll leave you to decide what you think of that. But interesting, isn't it, that even the opposition politicians are now also being caught out, or so it seems, and being accused of similar things, and we're seeing the same process again. You see people standing up in the House of Commons with real indignation and frustration and what a terrible thing you've done, and we would never do that. And actually, there's pride in all of us. But do we see it in our own lives as well? Do we see that temptation to pride, to put up ourselves in the place of God? Well, Isaiah gives them two examples of what that looks like in their history. The big problem is pride. Stop trusting mere people. Stop trusting their pride. And then he gives two examples. It seems to me that one of the examples is particularly focused at the men of his time and the other at the women of his time. In our time, we may feel it's not quite so polarized as that, but certainly in Isaiah's day, it was. And the main problem the men had is their pride was their leadership. The men all wanted to lead and did lead. And don't trust that power, don't trust that authority, Isaiah says, because God will take it away. And for the rest of us, let's not envy the heroes and the great and the impressive or feel that miserable because we're not like them, because none of that will last. So chapter 3 starts like this. "See now, the Lord Almighty is about to take from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support, all supplies of food and all supplies of water. The hero and the warrior, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the man of rank, the counselor, skilled craftsman and clever enchanter." See, Isaiah is predicting that the city is going to be surrounded and it's going to be they're not going to be able to get any food in or out because the invading Assyrians and later the Babylonians are going to come and surround them, so they won't have what they need. God is about to take from Jerusalem both supply and support, verse 1, all supplies of food and all supplies of water. Well, that happened as a kind of warning in Isaiah's time. The Assyrians kind of started it. Then 100 years later, it happened more finally. The Babylonians came and finished the job. And the other thing that God is going to remove is the powerful leaders of the time. They went into exile, into Babylon, people like Daniel and his colleagues, anyone kind of important or wealthy or skilled. The hero, look at the words that they use to describe this. Do you feel the pride in these words? The hero. Would we love to be a hero? The warrior, fantasy movies and things and books that we read about warriors. Imagine ourselves being the warrior. The judge, the prophet, the diviner, the elder, the captain. Would you love to be the captain? Do you envy the captain? The man of rank, do we look up to people of rank? The ones with skills, verse 3. The ones who are clever, verse 3. These are the things that we tend to take pride in or envy. And verse 4, all of that is going to be taken away from Jerusalem. Verse 4, I will make mere youths their officials. Children will rule over them. In other words, there's nobody powerful or important or respected or skillful. Who's going to run things? Who's going to lead things? We'll have to ask the youth group, the children. No one else is around to do it. They're so desperate that it kind of gives this picture of somebody going back home and asking one of his little brothers, look, you know, we used to like the rich people to run things. Anyone who's got a big house, anyone who's kind of from the right family, anyone who's got a big bank account, let's put them in charge. Because they, you know, they must have done well to get there. We kind of look up to them. You know, they've kind of got the posh accent and the right school and all of that. But there's no one left like that. All those people have been taken away from Jerusalem. So verse 6, a man will seize one of his brothers in his father's house and say, you have a cloak. You be our leader. Take charge of this heap of ruins. You've actually still got a coat. You're the richest one here. You're the winner. You run things. Little brother doesn't want to, verse 7. But in that day he'll cry out, I have no remedy. I can't help anyone. I have no food or clothing in my house. Don't make me a leader of the people. Well, that's what it came to, I guess, in the time when the Babylonians attacked Jerusalem. That's what it felt like. And the leaders have been leading people astray. That's the real problem. It's a male problem, I think, in Isaiah's time in Jerusalem. And I think that's why he writes in verse 12, youths oppress my people. Women rule over them. My people, your guides, lead you astray. They turn you from the path. He's going to remove all these powerful men who thought that was important, and it'll be the women and the children who will have to run things after the invasion of the Babylonians. And why is that? It's because the guides led the people astray. They don't deserve their leadership role because they were leading in the wrong direction. Verse 14, the Lord enters into judgment against the elders and leaders of his people. It is you who have ruined my vineyard. The plunder from the poor is in your houses. The stuff that makes your house look so amazing and so full of good stuff was taken from people who needed it, really, at their expense. And so that's why the leaders are being humbled. Stop trusting mere people. Stop trusting their pride. Stop trusting their leadership. And then thirdly, stop trusting their beauty. And I think now Isaiah switches to address the women of ancient Jerusalem. And he's saying, don't envy those who look beautiful. Don't make it all about lavish luxury. Chapter 3, verse 16. The Lord says, the women of Zion are haughty, walking along with outstretched necks, flirting with their eyes, strutting along with swaying hips, with ornaments jingling on their ankles. Do you know what that looks like? I wonder if you've ever seen a woman flirting with her eyes. If you're not sure what it looks like, I'm not going to give you a demonstration. I don't think that would be helpful. But in your mind's eye, imagine someone strutting along with swaying hips. I think I probably better not demonstrate that either, but you can picture it. I'm sure you've seen it. This sense of, I've got this look, I've got these clothes, and I've spent so much on them, that somehow makes me better and more important than the other people around me who don't have that look and don't have those clothes. You just kind of want everyone to notice how you look and what you're wearing. But when the Babylonians, the Assyrians, when they attack and invade and there's no food or drink in the whole city, well, how are those impressive, posh-looking outfits really going to look? And really going to seem? How important is that going to feel on that day? Isaiah says, verse 18, in that day, the Lord will snatch away their finery, the bangles and headbands and crescent necklaces, the earrings and bracelets and veils, the headdresses and anklets and sashes, the perfume bottles and charms, the signet rings and nose rings, the fine robes and capes and cloaks, the purses and mirrors, and the linen garments and tiaras and shawls. They had plenty, didn't they? But it will be snatched away from them at the invasion. Verse 24, instead of fragrance, there will be a stench. Instead of a sash, a rope, I guess it's the kind of rope of captivity as people are dragged off into slavery. Instead of well-dressed hair, baldness. Instead of fine clothing, sackcloth, the clothing of repentance. Instead of beauty, branding. Well, it's still a problem for us, isn't it? Materialism that comes at the expense of the poor. I'm told, I don't remember if I've got this quite right, you can look it up later, that the world currently has enough clothes to clothe the population 3 or 4 times over. And of course, people are making the point that this is not great for the environment, this is not great for the planet, but people want to buy new things. And there's plenty of old clothes that's still perfectly functional and still working, but we don't want old clothes, we want new clothes, we want the new fashions. We want something that was bought this year, not last year or the year before, or the year before that, even if that is hugely costly for our planet. So it's still a problem for us, and I think perhaps not just for women, but for men as well today. But I guess for the women of ancient Jerusalem, when the city is finally invaded, well, they've been kind of competing with each other, not only on how good their clothes look, but also on who they're married to. It's kind of a way of saying, look, I'm married to somebody really important, and they've got a, you know, my husband's a banker. What's your husband? Oh, my husband's a lawyer. Oh, well, my husband was just chatting with a member of the cabinet the other day. Oh, yeah, well, my husband was at the garden party with Her Majesty. And, you know, people are kind of competing on who their husbands are, and the husbands are kind of getting all of this wealth at the expense of the poor people. And perhaps they want, you know, to please their wives, and they want their wives to have a better outfit than the other women of the town. And so they're willing to go to any lengths, and they feel that pressure to go to any lengths and do things they shouldn't do and oppress the poor in order to get more wealthy. And Isaiah is saying, well, how will it be on the day of the Lord? And this is what's going to happen in Jerusalem when the Babylonians invade. Verse 25, your men will fall by the sword, your warriors in battle, the gates of Zion will lament and mourn. Destitute, she will sit on the ground. In that day, seven women will take hold of one man and say, we'll eat our own food and provide our own clothes, only let us be called by your name. Take away our disgrace. In other words, all the men have been killed in battle. And these women who've been competing to have the richest husband and the best clothes, well, seven of them will be fighting over one man, and they'll say, we don't need any of your money. At least let us be able to say that we're married to you. A complete reversal of that pride. Stop trusting mere people, Isaiah is saying. Well, we've grown up, I guess, in a culture that is very used to us. If you've grown up here in the West, in the UK, you're very used to that idea of a fashion and of wealth and of lavish displays of unnecessary luxury. And so it's a message we need to hear, isn't it? Not to put our pride or confidence in that. And chapter 4 goes on to say we don't want to trust mere people because we have something so much better to put our confidence in, something so much better. There's a wonderful bit, we didn't read it, but I want to finish with it. The climax of this reading offers us something much better and tells us that God's presence is greater. God's presence, especially God's presence in Jesus, is so much greater than anything we would find in ourselves or in other people. You remember Isaiah's been talking about the city of his own day. He did the same thing in chapters 1 and 2. He does it again now. He's talking about the city of his own day, which has a dark future, and he was right about that. And then he looks ahead to the distant future and the final outcome and says, well, that will be a bright day. That will be a positive day. There'll be a new, restored Jerusalem. Verse 2, chapter 4, verse 2. In that day, it's the same day, the day of the Lord when God brings down the proud, will be the day when he replaces that pride with something so much better. In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel. Those who are left in Israel, in Zion, who remain in Jerusalem, will be called holy. All who are recorded among the living in Jerusalem. You see, some are saved. Not everyone has been won over by that proud pride. Some people have listened to Isaiah and other preachers and put their trust not in humanity, but in God. And so when God's judgment comes, there are some who are recorded to be still alive in the city. There are some who are left. After it's all over, and when things are restored and rebuilt, and you get this new Jerusalem, there's a new future. And what are people proud of now? What is beautiful and glorious now? What is the pride and glory? Well, it's what God is doing. In that day, the branch of the Lord, it's language Isaiah often uses for the Messiah, for the great king who is going to come, the descendant of David who will come and put things right. And that's what people will think is beautiful. That's what people will think is glorious on that day. That's what will fill the land with good things, the fruit of the land. That's what people will say. That's the pride and glory of those who are saved. Not proud of themselves or of human strength. Not thinking that's glorious, that's amazing. But looking at Jesus, looking at the branch of the Lord and saying that is true beauty. Not the beauty of good clothes, but the beauty of a godly life. The beauty of the fruit of the Spirit we might think of in the New Testament. The beauty of love and joy and gentleness and hope and peace and patience and kindness and self-control. Seen in the life of Jesus and in the life of those who know him. That's where their pride is. That's where their beauty is. And because of that beauty and pride, everything that was wrong is washed clean. Verse 4. The Lord will wash away the filth of the women of Zion. We've just been hearing about that. They thought their clothes were amazing. To God, it's just like filth. But he'll wash it clean. He'll wash it clean. He'll cleanse the bloodstains from Jerusalem. Those powerful warriors and heroes they had victims. There were people who were being beaten up or killed, and their blood was still kind of marking the streets and the walls. But when God comes, he'll wash all of that away. He'll cleanse it and purify it. He will cleanse the bloodstains from Jerusalem by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of fire. We hate the idea, don't we, that God would judge. But he does it in order to cleanse and to purify. Fire is often used in that way, isn't it? To cleanse something and purify something. And that's what he'll do for his people. So they'll be called holy, verse 3, on that day. Then the Lord will create over all of Mount Zion and over those who assemble there a cloud of smoke by day and a glow of flaming fire by night. Over everything, the glory will be a canopy. It will be a shelter and shade from the heat of the day and a refuge and hiding place from the storm and rain. This is language from much earlier in the Bible. God's presence was often lead the people and guide them on their journey. They were going through tough times. They were on the way. And God's presence would be seen as a fire in the night so they could see and follow, and a cloud in the day so they could follow that. And here Isaiah is saying he's looking forward to the time when the journey is over and the whole New Jerusalem, the whole city, is covered in the presence of God. The cloud and the fire no longer leading them, but the presence of God is now there and resting with them forever. And that presence of God, that cloud, that fire, that presence of God is like a canopy, like a tent. It's like a protective layer. If you live in a hot country, you want some protection from the heat of the day. And on the rare occasion that the rains come, it really kind of gives you quite a forceful blast of stormy rain. But God's presence protects from all of that and keeps the people safe. So the presence of God is so much greater than anything we can find in ourselves. A couple of weeks ago, my wife Catherine was away. I didn't want her to miss we love this, there's a tree outside of our bedroom window, and you can see that it pretty much fills the whole window when you look out of our bedroom. It doesn't look like this all year, sadly, but just a couple of times in the year, it's really worth seeing. And so I took a photo and sent it to her. I didn't want to miss it, because I know it will all fall down after a couple of weeks. And this picture that Isaiah uses of the branch of the Lord that will be beautiful and that will bear fruit. What he's saying is that, I don't know if you've got anything in your garden, if you kind of garden that you might show people around. I know some of you have got gardens that you might show people. I probably wouldn't show anyone around my garden, but you might show someone around your garden. And I wonder if there's something you quite like to make sure they've spotted and kind of pause and let them see it, particularly at certain times of the year. And taking pride and glory, well, for Christians, that is Jesus. We so much want people to see him. We don't really want people to see us. Not really worth looking at. Spend a lot of time looking at ourselves, we could get quite depressed. But spend a lot of time looking at Jesus. That's something to be proud of, something to glory in, something to enjoy. He's our presence, he's our protection, He's our hope. He's our future. He makes us holy. He cleanses us when he dies for us on the cross. We don't need to worry about anything that we might see in ourselves that looks dirty. It's washed away and clean by him. And something to take great pride in. I just want to finish by mentioning this little booklet by Timothy Keller. I encourage you to read it if this is an issue for you or for someone that you care about. It's only short, it's only a few short chapters. The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness. Let me just read what the author says. In an age where pleasing people, puffing up your ego and building your resume are seen as the methods to make it, the Bible calls us to find true rest in blessed self-forgetfulness. Gospel humility means we can stop connecting every experience, every conversation with ourselves, and can thus be free from self-condemnation. A truly gospel, humble person is not a self-hating person or a self-loving person, but a self-forgetful person. This freedom can be yours.